The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
There are things in our society that they find horrible, such as our treatment of old people.
Pulitzer Prize winner Jared Diamond is here to discuss his book, The World Until Yesterday. It's an exploration of what the modern, fast-paced West can learn from more traditional tribal societies. And...
He's got head injuries and severe scoliosis of the spine. The radiocarbon dates match and the stable isotope data matches, and then you get a DNA match.
Dr. Turi King was one of the scientists behind the verification this week of Richard III's remains. They were buried under a car park in Leicester, and I'll be discussing how science can make history that bit more accurate. Also, Robin McKee joins me to mark the passing of Scotland's most beloved astronomer, Archie Roy. We'll also discuss how the UK is preparing itself for massive electromagnetic storms from the sun. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Jared Diamond is an expert in the gallbladder, who's also an accomplished ornithologist and anthropologist. A large part of his work has found him living and researching within the traditional tribal societies in New Guinea. His latest book is an attempt to not only document these fast-disappearing societies, but to find lessons from them about how to live for those of us in the West. His book is called The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? And he came in to tell me more about it. Jared, thank you very much for coming into the programme. Your book, The World Until Yesterday, is all about what we can learn from tribal societies, what we in the West can learn from tribal societies. So let me step back from that just for a moment and ask you, what is it that sort of has fascinated you about them? When did you first start going to New Guinea and learning about these things, that sort of the first steps towards this book many, many years later?
I first went to New Guinea in 1964. Loved it, and I've been going back ever since, so I've been to New Guinea 26 times. New Guinea attracted me because it's geographically so diverse, it's got wonderful birds, and it's got 1,000 different languages and 1,000 different tribes that deal with the things that you and I deal with, such as bringing up children and growing older, but they have come up with different solutions to these universal human questions.
Well, why was it you went there in the first place? It wasn't for the anthropology. It was for the wildlife, wasn't it?
That's right. I went to New Guinea for two reasons. Birds. New Guinea has birds of paradise, bowerbirds, the most beautiful birds in the world. And I went there for wild adventure because New Guinea until recently had people using stone tools. So it had remarkable human societies and still does.
And just to make clear, you went there for the wildlife, but you're a practicing physician at the time.
Not quite. I was a practicing biomedical researcher. My training was in physiology. I was the world's expert on the gallbladder, but I had a side interest in birds from childhood onwards, and so I went to New Guinea for my work on birds.
So I suppose there's no surprise to anyone who knows your history then that the anthropology comes along as a sort of you come along as an excited scholar and end up with anthropology. So many, many decades later, let's zoom through this. Your book is about, as I said, what we can learn from traditional societies, and this is from your observations over many decades of dealing with people in New Guinea. Paint us a picture of what life is like there and how it compares to, you know, what traditional tribal societies in humanity might have been like, I don't know, 2 or 3 million years ago.
I can certainly compare what it's like in New Guinea with what it's like in the United States or in the UK. The societies there, they're small-scale societies, a village of a few dozen people up to a few hundred people, which means that you know everybody. There's never the issue of meeting strangers and figuring out whether the stranger is an enemy who's there to kill you or steal your wife or take away your pig. That's one thing. So you've got your lifelong associates. Traditionally, these were societies without writing. And so if you wanted to know something, you didn't look it up in a book or the internet, but you asked a person, particularly an older person. These are societies where life expectancy is shorter than in our modern society. Most people have died by their 50s, but there are few people who live into their 70s and 80s and they are repositories of knowledge. And New Guineans and traditional societies behave differently as far as bringing up their children. They don't micromanage the children, but children are considered to be autonomous individuals with their own will and capable of making their choices. And old age plays out differently. Old people are surrounded by their friends and relatives, and they're not packed off into an old people's home.
You call the Western society, you give it the acronym WEIRD, and that's not a pejorative thing. It's a Western, educated, industrialized, rich and democratic. You could argue that that's a successful thing. We've done well at curbing disease and making civil society. What is it that we've lost in moving away from the picture of society you've just described?
You're right that Western society has obviously done well in giving us a longer life and a materially richer life. But we've lost things. The most obvious thing we've lost has been social richness. Friends of mine who've worked in New Guinea or Africa make the comment that life in Africa is materially poorer but socially richer, meaning that one is constantly with friends. You have these friends for life out there. Loneliness is non-existent. Human contact is face-to-face. It's not mediated by email or telephone. When you're talking with someone, the person is not looking down in his or her lap to send a text message, but it's straight, full contact, which is exciting and can also be maddening.
What can we learn from this then? What is it? You're not going to take people's phones away from them. That's not what you're suggesting. You're not suggesting that we sort of stop doing that. And the idea that we should perhaps have more face-to-face contact is something we all deep down we know. It's kind of obvious. So what can we physically learn from these ideas that you've talked about? So, for example, the treatment of the elderly and children. You hinted at this earlier. How can we change the Western sort of ideal of Western sort of treatment of old people and young people?
In any sphere of human life, we can learn something from traditional societies because they're in effect for us thousands of experiments in how to operate a human society. They do things differently. Some of the things that they do may horrify us, such as occasionally abandoning their old people. Other things they do in ways that we admire, such as giving old people a much more satisfying life and rearing their children to be more precocious and socially skilled. For example, my wife and I, when we were bringing up our own kids, learned from what I've observed in New Guinea. We let our kids make their own choices insofar as it was safe to do so. We didn't micromanage our children as do most American parents today.
So that means letting them do whatever they like, taking risks, that kind of thing?
Up to a point, we did not let our children run across streets with 50 mile an hour traffic. But when one of our sons at age 3 saw his first snake and was fascinated and demanded a pet snake. He's a child whose will is not to be thwarted. He wanted a snake. Yes, we got him a snake. It was not poisonous. It was not an anaconda. It was a 1-foot non-poisonous snake, but he wanted a snake, and so we let him explore snakes. He gradually built up to 147 pet snakes, frogs, reptiles, amphibians, spent a decade or so going through a snake phase, gradually got through a snake phase, and then finally at age 22 told us one day that he decided the next day to enter culinary school and become a chef. Well, this was a boy who had learned to follow his own instincts and was not micromanaged by his parents.
Another slightly more dangerous lesson to learn from some tribal societies, certainly not all, is about vengeance. There are many societies where you basically take an eye for an eye. If someone murders someone in your family, you do the same to them. In the West, we've deputized that to deputized revenge, as it were, to police and to the state. You certainly can't be arguing that the traditional way of dealing with slights is the best one.
In some ways it is, and in some ways it is. You express it very well by, say, deputizing. Yes, the essence of a state government is that the state does not want its citizens to be taking justice into their own hands by going out and seeking revenge. And so the state has a monopoly on violence. As you say, the state deputizes the police. We would say that, yes, it's terrible if, when you feel a slight, you seek revenge against the other person. But the reality is that in a traditional society, the people that you're dealing with, the people who've slighted you, are the people in your village and the nearby village that you have to be dealing with for the rest of your life. So it's not the case that the first thing you do is go out and try to kill him. Instead, the first thing you do is to try to deal with the dispute in a peaceful way, and that is a much happier solution than in the West. Here, if there is a dispute, say you have a car crash on the way into work, the car crash is with a stranger whom you'll never see again, you never saw before. Who cares whether the stranger is mad at you for the rest of his or her life? But in a tribal society, you're going to have to be dealing with that person. And so the emphasis is on emotional reconciliation. Anybody who's been involved in a criminal or civil case in the UK or in the United States knows that the last thing that the government cares about is whether you end the dispute feeling good and able to go on in a relationship with that person with whom you had the car crash. The state cares about justice. And the result is that often people end up emotionally churned up for the rest of their lives as the consequence of civil and criminal disputes. That's not the case in traditional societies. So there's an example of how we can learn wonderful things from traditional societies.
Also, dealing with risk, there's some interesting stories about how when you're camping, when you go to New Guinea, you're told not to camp under trees. I mean, this isn't a big thing for you, but for them, it's a huge thing. Tell us about their dealing, how they deal with risk compared to us.
I'll give you how they deal with it and what I've learned from it. I learned from it when I was with New Guineans. We were camping out. I picked a campsite. It was under a beautiful big tree, and the New Guinean said, "No, the tree is dead," to which my response was, "That's ridiculous. It's not going to fall down for 40 years. And then I did the calculations. If every night you sleep under a dead tree and the chances are only 1 in 1,000 that will fall on you that night, then in 3 years, 3 times 365, you're dead. All right. For me, in my lifestyle, it's not a big risk for me that a tree will fall on me because I'm not camping out under trees every night. But this morning, I did the most dangerous thing I'll do all day today. I took a shower. Go through the numbers. You read the obituary columns of the newspaper and you'll see that for older people, slipping in the shower or on the sidewalk is a big cause, frequent cause of death or crippling. And again, go through the numbers. If you say your risk of falling in the shower is 1 in 1,000, well, at age 75, my life expectancy is 90, which means 15 years times 365. I have 4,475 showers ahead of me. And if my risk of slipping in the shower each time is 1 in 1,000, I'm going to die 5.5 times before I reach my life expectancy. So I have learned from New Guinea to think clearly about danger and be careful in the shower and on sidewalks and be careful driving and watch out for the idiot other drivers.
See, that seems to me like a good mathematical knowledge rather than tribal knowledge.
You may say it's good mathematical knowledge, but the vast majority of British and Americans and
Japanese, I agree with you.
They don't think clearly about it.
No, that's true. What about health? The traditional societies, you say if we eat more like some of them, then our rates of diabetes and other sorts of chronic illnesses will go down. Now, you know, you're trained in these subjects, so you are the expert, but I would argue, you know, with antibiotics, with statins, with all sorts of other things, surely we're healthier than them.
We live longer than them, than they do, but you and I and most of our listeners and most of our friends are going to die of stroke, non-communicable diseases, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, conditions of which from which traditional people don't die at all. And that's because of their lifestyle and our lifestyle. If you do not want to die of heart disease and type 2 diabetes and so on, you can reduce your risk greatly by adopting a more traditional lifestyle, that is a healthier diet, eat less food, more fiber, less salt, and exercise. I mean, it seems banal. You might say, why on earth do I have to read a book by Jared Diamond to learn that when the newspapers talk about it?
I was going to ask that next question. I mean, a lot of these things are, if you think about them sensibly, quite obvious.
A lot of these things are quite obvious, and yet we don't do them. And I'm hoping that reading a book by Jared Diamond will finally make people realize that these things are important.
Do you think that you know, our sort of comfortable, westernized, industrialized mindsets are ready for sort of a scolding like this?
our mindset is not ready for a scolding, but our mindset is ready to examine our own self-interest. If you want not to die of type 2 diabetes, there are many things that you can do that will virtually abolish the risk that you will die of type 2 diabetes. It's your choice. Do you want to die of diabetes or do you not want to die of diabetes?
It's one of those long-term things, though, isn't it? It's like smoking and cancer. You know that smoking is bad for you, but it's not going to affect you for 20 years, possibly, so you don't think about it. I mean, how do you begin to think long-term? Is that what you're arguing? Some respects, in terms of health.
In my case, one of the things that helped me thinking long term was having my children be born. My children were born just short of my 50th birthday. And when your children are born, you realize that you are in it. It's not just that you're in it for the next 18 years until you're off to university. Any parent of children knows that you're never finished parenting your children. Mine are 25 now, and I'm still engaged with them. So having children helped me realize that the status of the world in the year 2050 is not an imaginary year, although it's past when I was born in 1937. So I'm not going to be alive in 2050, but my kids will be alive in 2050. And therefore, I'm concerned about my own survival and my health, but I'm also concerned about the world in which my kids will live out their lives.
Now, some critiques of your book in recent months have included those who say that you cast some traditional societies as violent and warlike, and you must have read the, and you've responded to people at places like Survival International who said that your books are completely wrong, both factually, morally, they're dangerous for portraying tribal societies as more violent. Just rehearse for me what you think they've misinterpreted about your book.
Right. This is a remarkable discovery by Survival International. After my book had been read and critiqued by dozens of anthropologists and by New Guineans, you would think that if my book gave a skewed view of traditional societies and New Guinea societies, New Guineans and anthropologists themselves would have noticed it. But no, it had to wait for this one guy to discover, quotes, that my book was morally and factually wrong and extremely dangerous. They took particular objection to my reporting that traditional societies are more violent than state society. This is not a discovery of my own. There are many scholars who've studied the frequency, measured the frequency of violence in dozens of traditional societies and dozens of state societies, and the universal conclusion is that the probability of a violent death is about 10 times higher on the average in traditional and state societies, not because they're more evil or intrinsically more violent, but for understandable reasons. They don't have a central government to declare war and also to declare peace. They don't have a small professional army. Instead, all able-bodied men are involved in fighting and at risk of dying. They are prepared to kill women and children, whereas we consider that especially horrible. We have the facilities for taking prisoners and using prisoners. They don't. So, of course, they end up with higher death tolls. Unfortunately, there's a romantic view that traditional people are nice and peaceful and in harmony with the environment. And what's especially bad about Survival International is that their goals are the same as mine. I loathe people who mistreat traditional societies. The reason for not mistreating traditional people is that it is immoral to mistreat any people. But unfortunately, Survival International has fallen into the trap of saying that the reason not to mistreat them is that they're peaceful. They're not peaceful, even if they're violent. You should not mistreat people because, for understandable reasons, they're violent and they have to do certain things to their children and old people. The reason for not mistreating them is a moral reason. And unfortunately, if you say you shouldn't mistreat them because they're violent, and then you discover the facts are going to come out. Yes, they are violent for understandable reasons. You've then demolished the reason why you should not mistreat traditional people, and that's why Survival International's posture is so dangerous.
But how do you separate your own morals from those of the traditional societies that you go and visit? We've learned lots from them, as we've discussed, but if, for example, there is a high rate of violence or a murder or whatever else, how do you sort of leave your morals at the door to say, look, this is how that society lives? We admit it, we talk about it, but you know, I don't condone this, I don't enjoy this, sort of the side of them.
I've lived in traditional societies for 49 years, and very quickly I learned not to judge them by Western standards. They were judging me by their own standards. There are things in our society that they find horrible, such as our treatment of old people. But there are reasons why we do it this way and they do it that way. So Yesterday, someone with whom I was talking made a very interesting observation that I'd never thought of. He pointed out that my book does not take moral postures, and that's true. There are reasons that people behave the way they do, and the reasons that they behave differently in traditional societies from how they behave in the modern UK and the United States.
If someone from one of the New Guinea societies that you travel to, if they came to the United States and lived there as long as you had and came back to theirs and wrote a book and said, look, they've got these amazing iPhones and all sorts of other things that they text people through, and, you know, they don't kill each other so much and so on. Would a little piece of your heart break slightly that they would have these things? But then how would you, in a sense, it would be a shame not to allow them to take part in the sort of technical transformation we've had here.
When you say not to allow them, again, that's an important point. Traditional people will do whatever they want. Often there's a mistaken view that we are doing things to them. No, we're not doing things to them. They see what the other options are, and they adopt some of those options. They prefer to use steel knives than stone knives because steel knives are sharper and they keep their edge longer. They like to have medical care rather than dying of malaria. And in an area where there's 400 inches of rain per year, they like to have an umbrella. I was greatly surprised that among the first New Guineans that I hired and I paid them, I asked at the end, what are you going to do with the money that I paid you? And I thought I just imagined that they would get the wonders of modern civil. No, what they wanted was an umbrella. But it makes sense if there's 400 inches of rain per year that you want modern technology, an umbrella.
Is anthropology a difficult thing to write about for a biologist?
It's a difficult thing to write about if you're an anthropologist. Anthropology, it's not like molecular biology. If I disagree with you about what is the amino acid in the 137th position of beta galactosidase, the disagreement is going to get settled in a few months by an experiment anyway. So I'm not going to say you're an idiot. Maybe I'm an idiot, and I'm not going to go out on a limb. And in addition, it doesn't have big moral and lifetime consequences whether position number 137 of beta galactosidase is alanine or threonine. But if you say, for example, that the traditional societies, they are or they're not violent. There are people who have strong views about that, and it has consequences for how we view them. So anthropologists are understandably a belligerent lot.
And with different ideologies, I'm assuming. So therefore, you will get criticized from multiple angles on whatever line you take.
That's particularly a risk for me because I'm a middle of the roader. Opposite views that people take in, say, anthropology is, in viewing traditional societies, there are many people who view traditional people as barbarians, brutes who should be exterminated, driven off their land, dragged into the modern age. That's a widespread view. Another widespread view is that traditional people are paragons of virtue, greenies living in tune with their environment and peaceful, and it's we who are the brutes. Both of those extreme views are untrue. I'm a middle of the road. I look at traditional societies and I try to observe them for what they are. But if you're a middle of the roader, it means that you can get attacked from both sides.
What can traditional societies learn from us?
What can they learn from us? There are many things that my New Guinea friends learn from us. They learn from us about the possibility of education and getting jobs through education. They learn from us about the possibility of medical care and living to age 78 rather than living to age 41. They learn from us about the outside world and a much greater variety of things out there than there are just in New Guinea. And New Guineans, they're smart people and they select from what they see.
What's your next book about?
My next book, my first instinct is to say that will be revealed seven years from now.
But here's a hint.
I shouldn't just tease you. My next book is going to be about change in individuals and societies. I was living in the UK from 58 to 62, when in retrospect, Britain was in a period of peak change. And I'm interested in how Britain reacted to the end of the empire, the end of the fleet, the end of world predominance, but Britain didn't fold over and collapse. Britain has now found a new role in the world, and Britain is still rich and democratic.
Jared, we look forward to that. Thank you very much for coming in.
You are welcome.
The World Until Yesterday is published by Alan Lane, and it's available now in all good bookshops. Now it's time to take a look at this week's science news. Joining me is the Observer science editor, Robin McKee. Welcome, Robin.
Hi there.
You've written and read Jared Diamond. You've written about and read Jared Diamond's books. What do you make of the man?
Oh, I think he's fascinating, and he's also a very, very gifted writer. He's very clear, a good exponent of some very complex issues. He's had a bit more controversy with this book than he has in the past.
Yeah, we mentioned the interview, Survival International, this sort of group, the defending the rights and interests of traditional societies, saying that he's cast traditional societies as violent and all of this, and he rebounded quite heavily, strongly against it.
I mean, I don't think so from the book. I don't think he does. He looks at traditional societies, and he stresses the good points, and he points out that, you know, that they have flaws, and violence is, as far as I can see, it's a little. There's no police there, you know. That's why we don't have so much violence in Western societies. I don't think he castigates them or looks down at them or sneers at them.
But he's got quite a body of work, though. Guns, Germs and Steel, the quite important book about why some societies work and some societies don't. It's Collapse, his thesis on why some societies fall apart after a while. These are important books.
And starting with his first book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Chimpanzee, in which he picks out, it's interesting, he picks out this one aspect of modern human society is that he calls agriculture the worst experiment in human history. Because it basically produced a massively overpopulated planet that's undernourished. There's nothing in there to suggest a man who's sneering or is contemptuous of traditional societies.
It's an interesting argument. Also, agriculture gives us the sort of cities and urban allows us to live in technologically advanced places as well. The more people there are, the more ideas there.
Yes, you don't have to. You have to find your own food. You can do other things like become a journalist.
Yeah, and buy food from cafes instead. Let's move on from Jared Diamond. You can read your interview with him is still online. Long. Detailed, interesting. Even I found it interesting, Robin.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Are you all right?
Let's move on to another story. This is a sadder story. Archie Roy, a Scotland's beloved astronomer. Tell us about him.
Archie Roy was a great character. He was professor of astronomy at Glasgow University. And he was fascinated in archaeoastronomy. In other words, the use of the interpretation that many of the great stone edifices that we see around the country from Maze Howe to the Ring of Brodgar in the north to Stonehenge in the south were actually very complex calculating machines that could help you observe the seasons. He was a gifted celestial mechanic, and NASA used to use him in the 60s to help calculate the paths of their first probes to the moon, the unmanned probes. He was also very interested in psychic research. He was known as Glasgow's Ghostbuster, which is a wonderful term.
Do you believe ghosts existed?
Usually at closing time, but there you go.
Let's not forget one of his more important roles. He taught you something.
He taught me astronomy, I'm afraid to say. At least he tried to. He was a fantastic guy. He was a real showman. He had taught himself to be ambidextrous. He could write as well with the left as with the right. And his job was to teach first-year students. I took astronomy. This is going to be great. I love this subject. But in those days, the first 3 months you had the first term was spherical trigonometry. And it was 3 months of spherical trigonometry. And believe you me, that's not easy. And it was his job to teach it. And he taught it brilliantly. And he would start off his lectures. Often he would stand, he would turn around, he would address the class, and he would say, let's take two intersecting circles. And he had a piece of chalk in each hand, and he would just do two perfect circles on the blackboard with two majestic sweeps of each arm. And there it was, these two intersecting circles. And the first time he did it, there was a huge roar of applause from the back of the class, because the second and third year students had come back in to see him, just to see him do that. And it was absolutely lovely. He was adored by a student. He had a very nice dry, he was a sense of humour, he was a good raconteur, he was in big demand at Burn Suppers just because of his, you know, the nice stories that he told. He was a lovely man, and he lived to a good age, but very sadly he died of pneumonia just at the end of last year, much missed by all of Scotland's astronomical society.
Staying in space, Here's something else that happened last week. The Royal Academy of Engineering released a report about whether the UK is prepared or not for the effects of superstorms, these storms that come from space, from the sun rather, ejections of radiation and particles that could affect satellites and electrical systems all over the world. And given that these superstorms happen once every century or two, the last one, big one we know of, was in 1859, the so-called Carrington event. Back then, there were telegraph lines and a few of those things, and so they were affected. But in the 50 years since, we've built an entire civilization based around electronics, electronic circuits, electrical grids, GPS satellites, mobile phone networks, aircraft flying up in the upper atmosphere, of course, and these will all be affected by radiation. So the question was, from the Royal Academy of Engineering, are we prepared? And it turns out that despite cataclysmic stories that I and many of us, and I'm sure we all have written, on the advice of many scientists, we're actually more prepared than we think. But we still need to do a lot. So these things can give an extra radiation dose to anyone flying in a plane, of course, maybe affect some of the circuits. It turns out that some of the circuits in a plane, if a superstorm happened, would be affected, but you're not going to have planes dropping out of the sky, which is reassuring. Mostly they're going to affect GPS satellites, though. So the advice from the engineers, this was very practical, just keep a map in your car. you may just get lost for a while. But more important than that, GPS is used to synchronize time signals all over the place. So anything that GPS uses will be affected. The Americans apparently said to the British engineers, you want to be careful because their mobile phone networks will also be screwed if there's a big radiation burst from the sun. And what will we do then? Can you imagine your life without mobiles for even a day? And so these guys looked at this and they found something interesting. They found that American mobiles networks, yes, they would be screwed because they require GPS signals to synchronize all of their base stations. The British mobile phone network doesn't do that, so we'll be fine. Oh. So you'll still be able to phone people, which is useful to tell them there's been this. Just don't try phoning anyone in America, obviously. But other than that, I think that they, just on a more serious note, I think they were suggesting that someone needs to take this a bit more seriously, though, in government. UK Space Weather Board, that they suggested, needs to sit within Cabinet Office or somewhere near, that just coordinates all the different people who just need to make sure that transformers are hardened against power surges when there's a big storm, or that planes and other things are shielded properly. I mean, it could happen at any time, a solar storm, but it's kind of reassuring, right, to know that we're not going to be absolutely buggered.
I mean, part of my job as a science editor is to write lots and lots of scare stories, and you're turning around and saying this wasn't a scare story.
It was quite amusing.
You're ruining my career here.
In it was quite amusing. You know, the report was a very sober, brilliant document, and it's online at the Royal Academy of Engineering website if you want to have a read. But we did try, I think, in the press conference, like the journalists that want to. So hang on. So are any planes going to fall out of the sky? Hospitals, they're not going to work, right? Well, no, it's all going to be okay. We just need to be a bit more careful about it. It's tough. You walk out there thinking, oh, scratching your head. What is the top line? Britain's safe.
Britain's safe. Yes.
Britain's fine.
I just see the news editor going, oh, good.
Good, yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Robin, thank you very much. To read more about solar storms, Archie Roy, or Jared Diamond, go to the Guardian's website, guardian.co.uk/science, and guardian.co.uk/The Observer. If you've not got time to read Robin's feature on 30 years of genetically modified foods from last week in The Observer, why not download the all-new Guardian audio edition?
This week on the Guardian audio edition, from the Arab Spring to global revolution, why the protest movement is here to stay. The love of the chase. Are we hardwired to love running? And in our audiobook review, we look at dystopian science fiction from Hugh Howey in Wool and explore Charles Arthur's view of real-world technology in Digital Wars. To subscribe for free to the Guardian audio edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian. Or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian audio edition. A new way to get the whole picture.
This week, the remains of Richard III were found in a rather ignoble resting place, under a car park in the English city of Leicester. The verification of the skeleton's identity in the past would have been an archaeological conundrum, but with DNA testing, identifying the remains gets a little more robust. Scientists helped archaeologists and historians by extracting some DNA from the skeleton and comparing it to known living relatives of Richard III. To tell me how this was actually done, I spoke to Dr. Turi King from the University of Leicester, who was part of the team that verified the skeleton's DNA. So, Turi, tell me, how do you identify a long-dead king?
Ah, right. Well, first and foremost, you really do need a relative to compare the DNA to. And we were really fortunate in having Michael Ibsen, who'd already been identified. And then Professor Kevin Schur at our university, within a few weeks of sort of taking it on, had found a second maternal line. Now, when I say you have somebody you want to compare the DNA to, not just any old relative will do, and that's because of the way our DNA is inherited. Most of it's a complete mixture of all of our ancestors. But there's two pieces of DNA which are just inherited in a very simple way. And the one that I've been concentrating on to begin with is mitochondrial DNA. And you get your mitochondrial DNA from your mum. So mum passes it down to all of her children, but only daughters pass it on. And Michael Ibsen and this other individual are direct female line relatives of Richard III.
So let's just explain that. So this skeleton, Richard III's mother gave Richard III, Richard III his mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
And the genome of the mitochondria are identical. And then obviously Richard III's mother, Cecilia Neville, had other children.
She did.
One of which was a daughter. Yep. And there's an unbroken female line to Michael Ibsen.
That's right. So Cecily Neville passed on her mitochondrial DNA to Richard, but obviously also to his eldest sister, Anne of York. And Michael Ibsen and this other individual are female line only, no men in the chain, female line descendants of Anne of York.
Okay, so you have this very good genealogical information. So the thing to do then is to check the DNA for the mitochondrial DNA from the skeleton and compare it to Michael Ibsen's. And this is the match you found.
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, the thing to do was actually to check these two distantly related modern day individuals and make sure that they match. That kind of confirms the tree and kind of really solidifies it for us and make sure, yes, the tree, we think this is correct.
Okay.
And then the next thing to do was then compare that against the mitochondrial DNA from the skeletal remains and see if there was a match. And there was.
Tell me a bit more about the types of mitochondrial DNA out there. Are there lots and lots and lots, or are there specific types? I mean, how common are they? Could these two have shared the same mitochondrial DNA by chance?
Well, so you do get particular types of mitochondrial DNA that are more common than others. So you get ones that are quite common in Europe and ones that are quite common in Africa and so on and so forth. Now, this one is actually quite a rare one generally. It's found at just a few percent in Europe. There's actually not tons of data for the UK, but if you look at this on a database, MPOP, which is a database of thousands of mitochondrial DNA types from around the world, you actually don't find a single match.
Really?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's quite a rare type. Now, there is always the chance that they could share this by chance, but that's why I've always said, I mean, you have to take the genetic evidence alongside the other evidence. You wouldn't run a forensic case just on the genetic evidence. And so the fact that we've found skeletal remains in the part of the church where he was expected to be, the age is right, the sex is right, he's got head injuries and severe scoliosis of the spine, the radiocarbon dates match and the stable isotope data matches, and then you get a DNA match. You put all of that together and you've got a strong case.
So the DNA is one strong piece of evidence, but it's not the only one. And
absolutely,
you know, if you just had the DNA, I mean, as a scientist, what would you say the likelihood is that the this is the correctly identified skeleton of Richard III, if you just had the DNA?
Well, so this is where I haven't finished everything yet, but given that this is a rare type. Now, say it had matched skeletal remains that look like a 90-year-old friar, I would have gone, that's unusual. This is, you know, a relatively rare type. But the fact that it matches and it matches skeletal remains that have got all of this other evidence attached to it, then, you know, I'm happy.
You mentioned just there that there will be a paper eventually, yes, with all of this data in it, which is one of the things that some of the scientists who watched the press conference on last week, they were a bit concerned.
And quite rightly so, yeah.
Quite rightly concerned that the data being presented wasn't in a paper. And
no.
They couldn't see all of it and there was no peer review. But that will happen. So tell me what else, what sort of stage you're at with that, and what other analyses you'll be publishing in that paper?
Well, I want to complete the mitochondrial, do the entire mitochondrial genome. And then the next thing I'm really interested in doing is the Y chromosome line. My background is largely on Y chromosome, and I've been able to amplify up a bit of the Y. So I'm hopeful I'll be able to type Y chromosome markers. And the reason why that's interesting is because we've got modern day male line relatives. So when I was saying that our DNA is usually quite complex in how it's inherited, the two pieces that are different are the mitochondrial, which just comes down to the female line. Y chromosome has on it the gene for maleness, so it can only go down through the male line. And Professor Kevin Schur has identified a number of individuals around the world who are male line relatives of Richard III. They're actually descendants of Edward III, so you kind of have to go back up the tree and then back down again. So I've got their Y chromosome type, and I'm all kind of ready to go on the modern side. And what I'd really like to do is compare that against the Y of the skeletal remains, if I can, to see if there's a match on that side as well.
So if there's another match, then that's just another strand of evidence.
Another strand of evidence, yeah. Yeah.
And can I just ask how you got involved in the whole thing? I mean, it's such a wonderfully interdisciplinary project, yeah. This, isn't it? There's archaeologists, there's historians, there's genetic biologists, there's everything.
Well, I'm a bit interdisciplinary in that I did, my background was in archaeology and anthropology at Cambridge. And when I was finishing there, I got really interested in the genetic side of things. And everybody said, look, the best place to go for genetics, for sort of DNA fingerprinting, this sort of thing, is Leicester. So then I ended up doing genetics. So my background is archaeology, but then I've moved into genetics, and particularly using genetics as a way of looking at the past, essentially. So people knew about this in Leicester and rang me up and said, look, we've been approached about possibly doing this dig, and what do you think about doing DNA evidence? And I said, I mean, of course I was slightly skeptical, I think, as the rest of the archaeologists were, as in that we didn't think we would find anything. So I said, but no, you know, I'm interested if something comes up. And then it did, much to our surprise.
There's something also about the success of how molecular biology is getting more and more specific these days. The idea you can extract DNA that's readable from a skeleton that old. I mean, it sort of raises all sorts of possibilities of doing the same thing. And we've done it with woolly mammoths, of course, and all sorts of other things. I mean, is this a bit of a renaissance, a bit of a heyday for molecular biology?
Well, so there's been the next generation sequencing technologies that have come along in the past few years. And the thing about ancient DNA is that it's degraded. It's in short little pieces. And that's always made it quite difficult to be able to sequence. But with next generation sequencing, what you tend to do, you know, with modern DNA is you break it up into lots of little bits and then you sequence it. And well, with ancient DNA, it's already in little bits. So it's fantastic. I mean, I've been really lucky. I've worked in a couple of really fantastic labs. So in the University of Paul Sabatier in Toulouse with Dr. Patricia Balaresque and Laura Tenasso, where they've been doing things like getting the pox virus out of a 300-year-old mummy. And then with Professor Michael Hofreiter and Gloria Fortes up at the University of York, where they're working on things like cave bears. I mean, it's really interesting. And wolverines. I mean, just really fantastic, interesting research that's going on.
You have to be careful, I suppose, with the old DNA as well, because if you want to use this almost forensically, like you guys have been doing, you have to be careful about contamination. That must be a big bugbear.
That's the biggest issue, and that's why I needed to travel to two labs, because you need dedicated ancient DNA facilities, and we just don't have those at the University of Leicester. So, you know, I've been working with these two fantastic labs and going and doing the work there, and University of Toulouse then very independently verified it. So, it's being incredibly careful, making sure the DNA is not contaminated, but also making sure the work is verified in another lab, so you can be certain of what you're looking at.
Teresa, when can we expect the paper then?
I'm hoping in a few months' time. I've still got the work to get finished, but yeah, I'm hoping it's going to be a cracking paper when it comes out.
Well, when it is, when it comes out, do come back and tell us more about
it.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. Remember to stay abreast of breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. I'll be away now for a few weeks, but my colleagues on the science desk at The Guardian will be keeping the seat warm. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, for now it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.